Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Joe Heschmeyer here with us. And why aren't you Catholic is our topic. If you're not a Catholic and you'd like to call and tell us why you're not Catholic, you're very welcome here. And it can be, you can give us a stern talking to about your disagreements with the Catholic Church, or maybe you have a reason. You know, sometimes people share a joyful reason with us, but this counts. But they'll be like, "I'm not Catholic because I haven't made it into the church yet at Easter." And then, okay, then we have a good conversation. So these might be tough calls, these might be fun calls, whatever. But if you're not a Catholic and you would be willing to talk with Catholics about why you're not, the number is 888-318-7884. As I said, our guest is Joe Heschmeyer. And you may not know this, many people don't, but Joe is short for Joseph. And today is the Feast of St. Joseph. And Joe is not an aficionado, a devotee. I'm not sure what the strong enough word is of St. Joseph. As a matter of fact, he wrote a book called A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times. So I have to say, happy feast day, Joe.
Thank you very much. It is a real joy. I had the great joy yesterday. I was at a dinner. And I was kind of mingling before the dinner. There was kind of a social hour. And it turned out I was actually talking to two priests, and one of them was named Joseph, and the other one, his middle name was Joseph. So it was a very
Joseph's happy all around.
Yeah.
Nice. So, and
nice to really get to celebrate it.
Yeah. Yeah. So tell me about this feast and Lent. I'm going to get into the people can call and tell us why they're not Catholic, 888-318-7884. But I'm going to be honest with you. I don't usually share things that people say off the air, but I was listening to your conversation with somebody just before we went on the air, and they asked you, did you eat meat today for the Feast of St. Joseph? And you said, yes. What is that all about? What's going on for the Feast of St. Joseph?
Yes. Explain. I actually had tacos, which was great because my wife said, would you like to have tacos today? And the answer to that is almost always going to be yes.
Yeah.
So during Lent, we try to cut back on things that are indulgences. I think everyone knows this, that we want to have an attitude of what's called mortification, of just saying no to the body more. But within Lent, there are two solemnities, and one of them is today. It is the Feast of St. Joseph, and the other one is coming up quickly. It's the Feast of the Annunciation on March 25th. And these are days that are of sufficient solemnity. Seriousness is the literal meaning of solemnity,
yeah.
But it's not seriousness in like a dour sort of like, so, the negative sense of solemn, the sort of way. It's rather like these are major, major feast days. Like St. Joseph is entrusted with the care of the entire church. And so we want to really honor him in a special way. And you might say, well, why is St. Joseph entrusted with the care of the entire church? Well, if you think about the church in the sense of people who follow Jesus, for a brief time, the church is just Mary. You know, there's one follower of Jesus on earth because she's the only one who knows about it. And pretty quickly, there's two. It's Mary and Joseph. And Joseph has been entrusted with the care of Mary and the infant Jesus, the unborn infant Jesus. And so the entire church is entrusted to his fatherly protection. And so when we talk about Joseph as the guardian of the church, and when we, you know, have this, you know, high feast day, a solemnity to honor him, this is to show that this is something very serious. This is something very important. And so it's not just, you know, don't trivialize it. Don't treat it as just like a cheap excuse to, you know, celebrate and indulge and everything else. But it is supposed to be a bright spot, even during the Lenten season, where the importance of this is actually more important to focus on than the importance of one of the 40 days of Lent.
Ah, he's that important.
Yeah.
Joseph, he's that important.
There's very few, you know, there's an order of importance. There's an order of these things. And so there's very few things higher than that.
888-318-7884 is our number. If you are not Catholic, including if you're on your way, but you just we're still two and a half weeks away from Easter, so you might be getting close. If for whatever reason you are not Catholic, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Maybe you had never heard about the glory of St. Joseph, and that's what's kept you out. And now you want to come in, so give a call if that's you as well. You might call and say, Joe, I never knew he was the guardian of the church because God made him the guardian of the church. His own church he entrusted to him.
Yeah. I mean, for a long time, and this is actually, if you're fine talking about St. Joseph for a few more minutes,
I am. Let's talk about St. Joseph for a few more
minutes. Great. Because I did write a book on this topic. And one of the things that's really fascinating is there isn't much of a devotion to St. Joseph in the early days of the church. And one of the reasons for that is that Joseph was dead before Jesus' public ministry. I mean, almost certainly. The last time we see Joseph is the finding of Jesus in the temple in Luke 2, and then we never hear of him again. And so we don't know exactly when he dies, but almost certainly, it's before Jesus' public ministry. And so as a result, people would have known the apostles. They would have known Mary. But Joseph was only someone they would have ever heard about. So he doesn't seem to have developed like a tremendous following in terms of devotion early on. And then in the early church, there's a real pride of place given to the martyrs. And Joseph wasn't a martyr. And so as a result, you have this kind of overshadowing of Joseph. But I think it's even more than that because, and I've seen some theologians talk about this as well, that the church has to really take seriously the perpetual virginity of Mary and what that means before they can make sense of Joseph. That if you started with Joseph too early, of just being like, yep, you got Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, the message that would send would have been like, oh, yes, this is the biological father of Jesus. And so we had to first see the way that Joseph wasn't the father of Jesus before we were really prepared, perhaps, to see the way that he was the father of Jesus, because he is called both, in Luke 2, for instance. He is referred to as one of the parents of Jesus, but it's very clear from the other things Luke has said that he doesn't mean this to be a biological fatherhood, but it is nevertheless a true fatherhood. One of the ways, the way mentioned in Scripture, that Jesus is a son of David is that he is by law the son of Joseph. And legal sonship was actually more important in the ancient world than biological sonship. And so you see this all throughout both the Bible and throughout ancient texts. So, for instance, with the Caesars, Julius Caesar to Augustus Caesar.
Right.
They're actually uncle and nephew, but Augustus is the adopted son of Julius. And so he's able to kind of be the son of Caesar and then the next Caesar. And it doesn't matter that he's not his biological offspring. Well, similarly, in the Old Testament, you have what are called levirate marriages, where a man would, if a man died without having any children, his brother had a duty to marry the widow and bear children for the son who had died. And the children were the dead brother's children legally. And so it was kind of a fulfillment of these promises that had been made that he wasn't able to fulfill because he died. And so that whole way of thinking about things is very much lost to us. But all that's to say that it's perfectly fine to say Jesus is the son of Joseph, even though he's not the biological son. And then the last thing I'd say is all of us should take that very seriously, that you can be a son by adoption.
We should.
Because this is the way that we are children of God.
Right. That's it. All right. Joe Hessmeyer, our guest on his feast day. We've got some folks to talk to after we come back about why they are not Catholic. If you are not Catholic and you'd like to tell us why you are not one of us, 888-318-7884.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features texts of daily mass, prayers, articles, meditations, art commentaries, and more, in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church, on the web at Magnificat.com.
Carry the faith wherever you go. Watch the EWTN series, specials, events, and news streaming live from anywhere in the world. Streaming is available on the EWTN app for Apple, Android, and Amazon devices. Download the EWTN app at EWTNapps.com today.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. Joe and I working on Hard Problems during the break. Which Elvis Costello album has Angels Want to Wear My Red Shoes on it? Are you looking it up as I'm speaking?
You were absolutely right. It is My Aim Is True.
The first one, yeah, that he made with Clover.
Yeah, it's not this year's model, yeah.
Hey, why aren't you Catholic? If you are Elvis Costello, you're welcome to call and tell us why you're not Catholic. Anybody can call and tell us why they're not Catholic. 888-318-7884. We're coming right out here to California. Uri here in California. Uri, why aren't you Catholic?
Hey, Joe, I appreciate all you've done with Catholic Answers and also Shameless Popery. I've been listening to that podcast and enjoying it. Just to let you know,
thank
my
you
name
much.
Is Yuri, Y-U-R-I.
Oh, Yuri. Okay,
oh,
gotcha.
Oh, like Yuri Gagarin.
Gotcha.
Yes, well, exactly like that. I'm actually from Ukraine. My question is not exactly a question, but more of just a confusion, I guess. So with a bloody sacrifice, that's immediate and offers immediate, complete forgiveness of sins. So my question is, how does the bloody sacrifice relate to purgatory and indulgences? And maybe it's a category error I'm making.
Yes, it is a little bit of a category error. But let's talk about those two things, if you're okay with it, in two parts. Let's talk about the way bloody sacrifice works and then talk about the role of purgatory and indulgences after that. That sound good?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. So when you have a sacrificial offering, animal sacrifice, anything like this, there were these entire categories of sacrifice that were food offerings that were not completed as sacrifices with the killing of the animal. They were completed with the eating of the sacrificial offering. And this is the way we understand things like the Eucharist. It's also the way we understand things like the Passover. So let's talk about the Passover first. In the Passover, you were required to kill the Passover lamb. That's how we usually describe it. But that's actually a little overly simplistic, because it was possible that a family was too poor to own their own lamb. And so they could go in with another family, and a single lamb could be an offering for both of them. But also, the members of the family weren't the ones who actually killed the lamb. The priest was. And so if you're a member of the family, the question is, well, how are you participating in the Passover sacrifice? If you didn't raise the lamb, if you don't own the lamb, if you didn't kill the lamb, if you weren't the one who smeared the blood of the lamb on the doorpost, what is it that you did exactly? And how are you part of this sacrificial offering? Or how is the sacrifice applied to you would be another way of asking that question. Or how do you become a partner in the sacrifice? And the answer to that is, you became a partner by eating the sacrifice. And so the Passover meal is part of the Passover sacrifice. That preparation day with the killing of the lamb and the first day of unleavened bread, the Passover, these two moments that are separated in time are two aspects of one sacrificial offering. And the way later theologians will describe this is the bloody and the unbloody participation in the sacrifice. That one way is this bloody way, you know, the slaying of the lamb. And the other way is this unbloody, where you're eating the slain lamb. Now, bring that forward to Jesus, to the cross, to the Eucharist. St. Paul in 1 Corinthians refers to Jesus as our Paschal or Passover lamb. And in John 19, Jesus' death on Good Friday is described as Preparation Day, which was, of course, the day that the Passover lamb was killed. But that's not the completion of the Passover sacrifice. Like that by itself isn't actually enough. There has to also be an eating of the Passover meal. And so what is that eating of the Passover meal? It's the Mass. And it begins at the Last Supper, which Jesus describes as a Passover. He says, I've eagerly desired to eat this Passover with my disciples. And so in 1 Corinthians 10, St. Paul makes this connection. He asks the question that how it can be that the cup of blessing which we bless is a participation in the blood of Christ, and the bread which we break is a participation in the body of Christ. And one of the ways he answers it is to say, consider the practice of Israel. Are not those who eat the sacrifices partners in the altar? So right there, he's telling you the bloody portion of the sacrifice is not the only important aspect of the sacrifice. You also have this unbloody participation where you become a partner in the sacrifice by eating the sacrificial offering. So Jesus gives us his body on the cross, and it's important that we have some means in which we can become partners in the sacrifice, and the Eucharist is the means by which that happens. So that's the bloody, unbloody thing. I'm happy to talk about purgatory and indulgences now, but before I get there, any questions, pushback, comments that you've got, Yuri?
Yes. Hey, so Joe, I've heard that argument before, and I love it. And that's something that I'm at a Protestant church, and when I talk about it to other people, I'm like, oh, I'm looking into this, and this is like a typological, but really consistent system of looking at sacrifice, and I was just like, it's very, very exciting. And so I am actually, conversion is not off the table for me at all. So I love that Glory. Illustration. I think it's very, very consistent typologically and theologically to actually a nuptial union act with Christ. So
yes, well said.
Yes, and that's what I'm getting from Christopher West and others. So I'm very excited about that. I think that's very consistent. Now, when I read the text in Exodus 12, there are four steps. There's selecting the animal, and this is what I got from you from an episode. Selecting the animal, killing the animal, spreading the blood in the right places, which is a very Old Testament thing, and then eating the animal. So, but I didn't notice a necessity of eating the animal in the text. It seems that there are three things that are necessary, and then eating the animal is actually not exegetically necessary. So my thinking from what your answer is, and I'll let you go to purgatory really quick, is that the necessary aspect applies to those who do not participate in the three other aspects of that. So the priest doesn't necessarily need to eat the sacrifice because a priest is the one doing the three other things, selecting, killing, and spreading. But then those who are not doing that act have to eat the sacrifice to become part of that sacrifice.
I think that's a pretty good take. The place I would point you to is actually Exodus 12, 8 to 10. They shall eat the flesh that night roasted with unleavened bread and bitter herbs they shall eat. Do not eat any of it raw or boiled with water, but roasted, its head with its legs and its inner parts, and you shall let none of it remain until the morning. Anything that remains until the morning you shall burn. So, you know, the eating isn't optional in a general way, but you're right that there is some ambiguity in the Passover instructions in terms of, no foreigner can eat of it unless they've been circumcised. That's actually down in verse 43. And so you have this restriction on who can receive, who is allowed to eat. You have sort of a, if you will, a closed communion. But then it says after saying who can't eat it in verse 43, 44, 45, then says, in one house shall it be eaten. You shall not carry forth any of the flesh outside the house, and you shall not break a bone of it. Which, by the way, in John's gospel, when they don't break Jesus's bones and he says this is to fulfill the prophecy, that's the prophecy he's talking about, which is pretty fascinating. And then he, and then it says all the congregation of Israel shall keep it. But that seems to present the eating of the Passover as necessary for the entire congregation of Israel in terms of eating the sacrifice, forbidden for those who are foreigners and uncircumcised, and optional for those who have been circumcised, like, for example, foreign slaves.
Interesting. Okay, cool. Thank you so much. And then if you have a chance to answer the purgatory.
Yes, awesome. Yes. Okay, I'm loving this conversation. The purgatory thing deals with what are sometimes called the twofold consequence of sin. And so this idea is pretty simple, that sin does two things. One, it cuts us, like serious sin, mortal sin, cuts us off from communion with God, and it cuts us off from salvation, and it puts us on track for hell. And does this in a way that we are actually incapable of repairing the damage simply by ourselves. And this is one of the reasons why Christ's death on the cross is necessary for our salvation. But there's another aspect of sin as well, which is that it harms us in these other ways. These are what are called the temporal consequences of sin. And this is an area that, even though this language doesn't really exist within Protestantism as often, I think these ideas are often things that Protestants will agree to when you sort of present them, namely that we are called to an ongoing aspect of sanctification and an ongoing aspect of purification. And the idea is very simple, that nothing impure will enter heaven and nothing impure will enter the New Jerusalem, as the book of Revelation says. And so as 2 Corinthians 7 says, since we have these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from every defilement of body and spirit and make holiness perfect in the fear of God. So in one sense, we've already been purified. In one sense, we've already been freed from defilement through Christ's death on the cross, through the application of his death in our baptism and in the Eucharist. But there are these other ways in which Paul can write to a group of Christians and still talk about an ongoing need for us to cleanse ourselves from every defilement of body and spirit, and that we still have this ongoing need to make holiness perfect in the fear of God. So there is this ongoing journey of spiritual purification. And this journey is often painful. If you've ever tried to break a bad habit or get rid of an unhealthy influence in your life or cut off, you know, sinful relationships or anything like this, then you know that this battle for purity, this battle against even a this slightest defilement, the slightest imperfection in holiness, is a battle that is a difficult one. I mean, are we, I guess, agreed so far in terms of that vision of things?
Christians, we're all Christians, I think. Protestants would say, oh, that's sanctification, progressive sanctification.
Right, but they wouldn't say sanctification in any way diminishes the work of Christ on the cross, right?
No, of course not.
Right. So I want you to keep this in mind, because almost every objection against purgatory, if you took it seriously, would be an objection against sanctification. Because the argument is, oh, why do you have anything to do? Christ did everything on the cross. And it's like, what are you talking about? Of course you've got things to do. This is progressive sanctification.
Uh-huh.
That the person who is justified still has this ongoing fight against sin and impurity. And in 1 Corinthians 3, St. Paul can talk about groups of Christians who have built on the foundation of Christ. And he says no other foundation can one lay than the one which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. So he's only talking about Christians here. And then he talks about those who build on that foundation with gold, silver, and precious stones, but then about those who build on it with wood, hay, and stubble. And he says each man's work will be manifest, for the day, judgment day, will disclose it, because it will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. If the work which any man has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. If any man's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but only as through fire. So it's possible for someone to die in a state of imperfect purification, but still justified, still in relationship with Jesus Christ. Purgatory doesn't achieve justification. Purgatory doesn't achieve salvation. Purgatory is only for those who are already saved, just as sanctification is only for those who are already saved.
Yeah.
And then it's just a matter of that difficult, painful process of being purified enough to stand before Almighty God in heaven. And the image St. Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 3 is of being saved as through fire. The image that we get in Isaiah 6 is when he sees God in heaven, he says, you know, woe is me, a man of unclean lips and a people of unclean lips. And the angel takes a burning coal from the altar in heaven and purifies him through fire. And so purgatory is drawing on this very biblical understanding that we are to be saved, but we're even more than that, to be made radically purified, and that God will not accept anything less than a radical configuration to be like him.
That does, as you can hear, Yuri, bring us to the break. Thank you very much for the call. Quite a few more calls on, and people have been gracious enough to call and tell us why they are not Catholic. If you want to tell us why, 888-318-7884. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Do you have what it takes to defend your Catholic faith? The work of apologetics takes study, practice, and skill, but more than anything, it takes spiritual strength. The Soul of Apologetics, a new prayer resource from Catholic Answers, gives you the spiritual tools every Catholic apologist needs: prayers, meditations, and scripture-based reflections to build up the interior life. Order your copy of The Soul of Apologetics today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron. Why aren't you Catholic? That's what we're asking you. If you're not a Catholic, you're welcome to call and tell us why you're not Catholic, 888-318-7884. We are, as you might have guessed, given the name of the program, is Catholic Answers Live. But we like talking to people, and we like talking about the Catholic faith, and some of the most fun, most interesting, most productive conversations we have are with people who are not Catholic. And if you want to challenge us on our Catholic faith, maybe you just would like an explanation of something in the Catholic faith. If you're not Catholic, 888-318-7884. We're going to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where Annette is. I thought everybody in Baton Rouge, Louisiana was Catholic. Am I wrong about that, Annette?
Well, there's lots of us. We have a heritage of Spanish and French and Italian, so that accounts for a lot of them, and many Germans, too. But I wanted to share my family's great devotion to St. Joseph. I come from many, many generations of Catholics, and most of us had large families. My father was one of 13 children. There were 7 girls and 6 boys. My grandparents, his parents, had 57 grandchildren. And
beautiful.
All of my uncles were big families, and all of my uncles, my father included, my father and all my uncles, their middle name is Joseph. And there were lots of Josephs in the family, if not the first name, the middle name. And in the next generation, which is my generation, we have the same thing. Joseph is the middle name, and there's several cousins of mine whose first name is Joseph. And one of my brothers, I have six brothers. My parents had 10 children, and I have six brothers. One of them was born yesterday. Well, his birthday was yesterday, and so he was named Patrick Joseph.
Oh, that's perfect.
Because he came right in the middle. Yeah.
A three-day celebration right in the middle of Lent every year.
Exactly. Patrick, and the chaplain at the hospital recommended that. I think they were hoping for a girl. You know, they didn't make preference, but they had picked out
Patricia
a girl.
Patricia Josephine would have worked as well.
Yeah, right, exactly.
That's true. So his name is Patrick Joseph. We had a party for him last night. But we knew Joseph. We knew very well that Joseph wasn't the natural father. You know, we understood the situation. We knew he wasn't the natural father. But the families were so large, and believe me, we had a great appreciation of people of taking care of your own children, much less of someone else's. So Joseph was entrusted with the care of Jesus, and we make reverence to him for that.
Beautiful. I love the witness.
Oh, Annette, I'm so happy you called. First of all, I could listen to your Louisiana accent for the rest of the night. You can just read the phone book and I'll be fine with it. But what a beautiful story. Oh, so many, a whole entire family honoring St. Joseph.
That's right. Well, what you said about my accent, my husband died recently. He was from the state of Pennsylvania. Oh, yeah. And the first time I met his whole family, he also was from a large family, the oldest of eight. And I thought all his family was deaf. I was so young and I was so naive. And every time I'd say something, his brothers would say, "What? What did you say?" I said, "What? What did you say?" And I said, "Are all your brothers hard of hearing?" He said, "No, why should you ask?" Because I said, every time I say something, they want me to repeat myself. He said, "Oh, they never heard anyone speak from Louisiana." He had a lot of fun.
They're from Pennsylvania. They say "wooder" up there. They don't know how to talk English.
I asked for a glass of water. I asked for a glass of water. They say, "What about that?" You know, that clear liquid stuff you drink.
That clear liquid stuff. What a great call. Annette, if you'll hang on, let's send her one of Joe's books, any one of Joe's books that we publish, all right? The Eucharist is Really Jesus, or Pope Peter, or the early church was the Catholic Church.
I should have just done that titling theme.
That should be all your books would be, start with a man named. What a delightful call. I'm so glad we got to talk with Annette. I forgot St. Patrick, and then 2 days later, St. Joseph. I don't know if you remember Father Guido Sarducci. But he didn't like Saint. You know, he's Italian, so he didn't like Saint Patrick, and he said he's kind of a mediocre saint. And he goes, "Why does this mediocre saint overshadow a great saint in Saint Joseph?" It's a great bit.
Very funny bit. And for those who don't get the context, number one, this is SNL. This is not a real priest. Number two, there's a huge devotion to Saint Joseph in Sicily, and so Southern Italians, particularly Sicilians, have this. A wonderful devotion to Saint Joseph.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, just you think about the Irish with Saint Patrick. It's something similar for the Italians.
He says about Saint Patrick, he was a good saint, but not a great saint. Joseph was a great saint. All right, Ned, what a great conversation. Thank you. Let's go to our very good friend Emma in Hayden, Idaho, watching on YouTube. Hi, Emma. Welcome back.
I loved Father Guido Sarducci.
I know. That was before you were Catholic, too, huh, Emma?
He was a good saint.
He was a good saint. But not a great saint.
But not a great saint. Anyway.
Can I say something to you, Emma, before you ask your question?
Yeah.
Do you know that I'm coming to Moscow, Idaho in 1 week to
you
do a debate?
You are not. When?
In 1 week. I'm going to be in
He
Moscow,
doesn't know the
Idaho.
Date. That's why he said 1 week. He can't remember the date.
It's Thursday the 26th.
Okay,
I just checked.
Thursday the 26th?
Yes.
I'm looking at
It's going to be on Sola Scriptura. It's the Vandal Catholic 6th Annual Great Debate at the ICCU Arena, which I assume means more to you than it does to me. It is at 6 p.m. It's in Idaho Central Arena, it looks like. Idaho Central Credit Union Arena. So,
yes.
At the University of Idaho. So,
yes. My problem is I can't drive at night. I can't see at night, but I'm going to bribe my husband.
Bribe
him? Yes, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And come up and say hi.
I'm so excited to meet you. I will. Okay, I am Catholic, but I've got three women in my life that are SSPX, and they're hot on my tail. And they give me cassettes and books and all these things to read. It sounds good to me, but I don't have any ammunition for them. I don't know. Joe, you need to write a book about this.
About why not to be SSPX?
Why not to be SSPX?
Yes.
Tell me, Emma, what is the thing that you're finding attractive in it?
I like the kneelers. I like the traditional mass and that type of thing. But they also say that non-Catholics there's no way you can go to heaven if you're not a Catholic. I don't know. I mean, it just sounds like the pre-Vatican II, it's like the devil was all in Vatican II.
So let's unpack this bit by bit. Number one, a love for tradition is good. I'm not going to knock a love for tradition. Some of the things people did in the name of Vatican II, like taking out the kneelers, were not things Vatican II ever called for. And so it may be that you have a perfectly legitimate grievance against the way the Mass is celebrated. I don't know how the Mass is there in Hayden, and I'm not even going to ask because this isn't that kind of show. But it may be that there are things that need to happen to restore a greater sense of reverence and devotion. And I think we've seen throughout the country, throughout the world, that the places that lost that sense of reverence and devotion lost huge numbers of Catholics. And it's hard to overstate the damage that loss of reverence, that loss of devotion has done. And you can see it in the data that Catholics left in droves and they're not coming back. And the Catholics that are coming, the Catholics who are converting, the Catholics who are going deeper in their faith, the Catholics who are entering seminary and doing all these things, are the ones who are often, not exclusively, but often, much more self-consciously rooted in the tradition. That there is a sort of ephemerality to some of the things that happened 50 years ago liturgically, and that you can sometimes find even now. I think that form of Catholicism is largely dying away. And I think something more robust and more serious, frankly, is replacing it, and it's something that looks much more like the Catholicism we've seen throughout the ages. So in as much as you have a frustration with a lack of reverence or those things, that's not something that you have to say, therefore Vatican II bad. You can just say, yeah, don't do that. And it's bad that people did that in the name of Vatican II. There is an attempt by the church, an ongoing one, to sort of right the ship in this regard. And to this end, it's been very fascinating to watch the Wednesday audiences from Pope Leo, because one of the things he's doing after Vatican II, there were two theological camps. One of the camps was the camp of Ratzinger and some of the other theologians associated with him. And it was about interpreting in the reforms of Vatican II in a way that was much more consistent with the spirit of what had come before. And then there was this other camp called Concilium, that wanted a much more radical kind of break from tradition. And so this became known as the Communio and the Concilium camp. So Communio, that journal broke away when the Concilium guys got too crazy. And I mention this to say that Pope Leo repeatedly has quoted the Communio theologians in the interpretation of Vatican II. Like, he's telling us which camp is the correct one. So if that's your concern, then rest easy that if you're concerned about excessive, you know, liberalizing tendencies after Vatican II, I think there's good reason to see the Pope as of one mind with you on that. Now, second, even in terms of the traditional Latin Mass, this is something which I know has been controversial in the church, but there are things like the Fraternity of St. Peter. There are things like the Institute of Christ the King. And depending on the diocese, there are diocesan Latin Masses as well. And so the question then becomes, well, why Society of St. Pius X instead of a Latin Mass that's approved by the church? Because what the Society provides is this posture of, as you put it, treating Vatican II like everything in it was of the devil. And that is an irreverent attitude to have towards an ecumenical council. And so to acknowledge Vatican II as an ecumenical council and then to treat it with that kind of disdain is not traditional. It can happen that an ecumenical council has what are called the disciplines, ideas that don't work out well. Like in the history of the church, there have been things that councils have tried to do that didn't succeed. That's fine. But we don't treat them as of the devil or heretical or bad just because some of their attempts at reform don't always succeed when put into practice. Like nothing in the infallibility of the church promises that every effort we're going to make is going to work out well. And so it's fine to even say some of the reforms proposed by Vatican II didn't launch very well without having to attack the council, without having to have that posture of disobedience towards the magisterium of the church and towards the visible successor of Peter and the Pope. So the Society of St. Pius X would agree. Pope Leo is the valid successor of Peter. He is the Pope, and we owe him deference and we owe him obedience. And they would agree. The Second Vatican Council is one of the ecumenical councils of the church. And it's not some lesser, you know, tier two council. We have no, it's not like a regional body. It's an ecumenical council. It's got that highest level of authority. And so given that, it seems to me that the traditional thing to do is to treat it the way we would treat every other ecumenical council and to treat the Pope the way we would treat every other Pope. And that somebody proposing something different than that is not defending tradition. They're breaking from it. And this is particularly true today as this issue of unapproved ordinations is a live option, which might result in the leaders of the society and maybe even some of the members being excommunicated for schismatic behavior.
Okay, Emma?
That makes sense. And I think the thing that breaks my heart the most is the division.
Yes, I agree.
Disillusioned in Protestantism because of all the divisions. And so it's just, it's sad to me.
The enemy is the accuser, and he comes to divide. And it's something we have to be very much on our guard for, and that we should be striving for unity. You know, Jesus's prayer in John 17, that we'll all be one, as he and the Father are one, so the world can believe in the gospel. Unity in the church is not optional. It's not just some, you know, liberal whatever pablum. No. This is a gospel imperative. And if we don't take the unity of the church seriously, and that's true whether we're talking about denominationalism and Protestantism, that's true whether we're talking about infighting in the Catholic Church. If we don't take the call to be one in mind and in heart very seriously, that we should be united theologically, but we should also be loving towards one another. And people should look at us and see a group of followers of Jesus Christ who deeply love Jesus and their neighbor and think about the effect that would have. Think about how much more people would want to be part of that church.
Emma, thank you. I'm past the time for the break. So as you understand, I got to go. But lots of folks on the line want to tell us why they're not Catholic. We'll continue that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
One of the biggest mistakes a Christian can make is to try to do good without God's help. Saint Therese said, "When we trust only ourselves and not God, our soul becomes incapable of virtue." Her remedy, works of charity. And the greatest work of charity is to share the gospel. At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we encourage you to share the gospel with someone who doesn't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. StreetEvangelization.com.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. I invite you to listen to Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. On Catechism in a Year, you'll encounter God's plan of sheer goodness for us. Throughout the year, we read through the Catechism of the Catholic Church with direct quotes, plus time for explanations and reflections. I hope you can join us every day or as often as you can.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz. Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. We'll try to get to everybody. We asked folks, why aren't you Catholic? And they have called to tell us. We're going to Tennessee now. Noah is in Tennessee. Noah, why aren't you Catholic?
Yeah, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So I guess to sum it up briefly, I'm an Anglican, really an Anglo-Catholic, I would describe myself as.
Okay.
And so there's a lot of overlap. I mean, I'm convinced of sacramental apostolic Christianity, and I'm deeply drawn to Catholicism in so many ways. There's a big part of me that is very drawn to it, and I've been doing a lot of studying on it, but you know, I guess the one big hang-up I have still, you kind of get in that analysis paralysis whenever you read from different sides of the issue, but as I'm reading church history, I'm still not convinced yet of papal infallibility and universal jurisdiction, at least in the first millennium of church history. And so I guess I just wanted some advice on, like, where's the best place for me to turn to get a fuller perspective on that? If I could say something really, really quick about kind of the stakes for me, too.
Yeah.
You know, I want to be where Christ Church is. I want to be where Jesus is.
Yes.
If the Catholic Church really is what he has set up as the one true church, that's where I want to be. That's where my heart is. At the same time, I'm also in a situation where if I were to go that route, it'd be a very huge personal cost for me. I know I would be breaking with my family, so many of my friends, and it would cause a lot of rupture in my personal life. And so I'm willing to do that if that's where Jesus is, if that's where Jesus wants me to be. But I'm very hesitant to make that jump unless I know that, if that makes sense. So.
Yeah, that's a very, I mean, it's a significant issue. And I love the seriousness with which you're approaching it, and even your willingness to put everything on the line to follow in the way that Jesus is calling you to follow him. I would say take heart. You know, like, it may be a time of difficulty if this is where he's calling you, and I suspect it is, that he will strengthen you and he'll take care of you in the midst of that. And so just to be courageous during that. If in terms of, like, resources, Eric Ibarra, his book on the papacy, I think is very good in this regard. It's just called The Papacy: Revisiting the Debate Between Catholics and Orthodox. He tries to be very even-handed in showing, like, why he's Catholic, as well as presenting what he sees as some of the limitations on some of the Catholic arguments, looking at the historical evidence. And I think that's very helpful to do. For myself, there are a handful of things that I would point to, both in terms of Scripture and in terms of the early church, that point me in the direction of the papacy being true, of the Catholic Church being true. One of those is just that Jesus founds one church. Like, the branch theory doesn't work. You know, the theory that there was one church and now it's just divided in these three branches, none of which has the right to claim, like, the title of the one holy Catholic and apostolic church, that's not consistent with creedal Christianity, and it's not consistent with Jesus saying that he will build his church and the gates of hell won't overcome it. Because a sort of fractured and shattered church where no one can say what communion we're all to be part of is not a workable solution for Christianity.
Like, this is a problem in Protestantism. This is a problem in Anglican branch theory as well. That if someone said everyone on earth is meant to be Anglican, that would at least be a claim consistent with, you know, because I guess I'd put it like this. At the time of Christ, there is a visible church, right? And everyone is supposed to be part of it. And this is a very important part of why Jesus comes. In John 10, he talks about how he doesn't just have faithful Jewish followers. He has sheep that are not of the flock. But, he says, this is John 10, 16, and I have other sheep that are not of this fold, but I must bring them also, and they will heed my voice. So there shall be one flock, one shepherd. And then later, in John 21, we see him entrusting the care of that entire flock to St. Peter specifically. And this is, I think, a very important way of understanding the role of Peter. That the role of Peter, especially in the Gospel of John, I think you see it very clearly. You see it earlier in John 21, where Simon Peter says, I'm going fishing, and the other six apostles say, we will go with you. This is an image being given at a spiritual level. Like in Luke 5, when they have the miraculous catch of fish, and Jesus tells Peter amongst the other apostles that he will be a fisher of men, that we should understand fishing there as a motif for evangelization. Or in Matthew 13, where in verse 47 to 50, he compares the church to a net containing good and bad fish. So here, Peter goes fishing and the others are to go with him. And so there's a unity there. And when, at Jesus' command, they cast the net on the other side of the boat, they catch so many fish they can't bring it in. All seven of them are unable to bring in the net. And then when they go to shore, Jesus says, bring some of the fish that you've just caught. And then in verse 11, Simon Peter single-handedly goes aboard and hauls the net ashore full of large fish. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. And the word there is the same Greek word used for schism, schismo. So there's no schism in the net if you have this Petrine kind of dimension. And this matches how the early Christians often spoke. For instance, St. Jerome, writing to Pope Siricius, said, since the East, shattered as it is by the longstanding feuds subsisting between its peoples, is bit by bit tearing itself into shreds, the seamless vest of the Lord, he says, I think it is my duty to consult the chair of Peter and to turn to a church whose faith has been praised by Paul. Now, he's very clearly writing to the Bishop of Rome. And he says to him, yet though your greatness terrifies me, your kindness attracts me. From the priest, I demand the safekeeping of the victim. From the shepherd, the protection due to the sheep. Away with all that is overweening, let the state of Roman majesty withdraw. My words are spoken to the successor of the fisherman, to the disciple of the cross. As I follow no leader save Christ, so I communicate with none but your blessedness, that is, with the chair of Peter. For this, I know, is the rock on which the church is built. This is the house where alone the paschal lamb can be rightly eaten. This is the ark of Noah, and he who is not found in it shall perish when the flood prevails. So he's very clear on the role of the Pope as the Bishop of Rome in this. And even before this, like 200 years before this, in 180, you've got Irenaeus saying of the Church of Rome that it is a matter of necessity that every church should agree with this church on account of its preeminent authority. So the juridical questions about day-to-day administration of the church misses the point. There is this basic spiritual reality that there is to be one church, and the way the church remains one is by having a visible source and principle of unity. And if you don't have that, if you have everyone following their personal interpretation of Scripture or everyone following their preferred successor of the apostles, you'll never have unity. St. Optatus of Milevis talked about this as well. He said that it was because of this. He says, you cannot then deny that you do know that upon Peter first in the city of Rome was bestowed the episcopal cathedra, that is, seat of authority, on which sat Peter, the head of all the apostles. And then he says, this is so that in this one cathedra, unity should be preserved by all, lest the other apostles might claim each for himself separate cathedras, so that he who should set up a second cathedra against the unique cathedra would already be a schismatic and a sinner. So from the early Christians, it's not enough to have apostolic succession. You need this unity with Peter.
Noah, if there's one of Joe's books that we can send you, I'd be happy to do that. Just hang on, talk with Edgar.
Peter might be a good...
Pope Peter would seem to be the obvious one, but it's up to you, Noah. Joe Heschmeyer, thank you very much for the hour today.
My pleasure.
And good luck in your travels going to Moscow. Have a nice trip to Moscow. Moscow, Idaho?
Yes.
All right. That'll do it for us. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.